resume that I sent?
Yes, yes, thank you.
Well, I was the first technical editor of the journal, and I worked at it for 2 years, and I thought that was enough. I had other things that took quite a bit of my time, and actually, on the publication committee, we had talked over matter of a technical editor and thought that ought to be changed about every 2 years. So, after 2 years, I was glad to turn it over to Norm. And he just kept it forever and anon. Actually, now, before we start, I'd like to ask a couple of questions, if I may.
Okay, I've got this on just so I don't miss anything, but what we will do is transcribe this. I'll send you a copy and...
Yeah, the first question was, will the tape be edited?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In other words, selected material will be taken.
Well, there are two aspects to it. One is that I will put together a relatively verbatim transcript, which I will edit before you see it. And then I will send a copy to you. You have control over what's there. And who can see it, what else happens to it. It's your property, as it were. Now, we're doing this for the Electrochemical Society, but nevertheless, and I have a release form here which indicates that. There'll be another one later on which you can control what happens to this material.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the Electrochemical Society, per se, will do with all of this material. And I know this is being done in preparation for their 100th anniversary, which is still a few years away. We will, I suppose, turn this over to them.
Mm-hmm.
But before that happens, you will see it, you will have control over it.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you've already answered what would have been my second question. And I'm on the a sort of a consultant to the anniversary, 100th anniversary activity. And one of the things that they propose to do is to offer the oral histories to anyone who may wish to listen. 2 hours or so, I presume the tapes will run about that, is a long time for anybody to listen. And I was wondering whether there would be some possibility of editing these tapes for that specific purpose, to be done either by you folks or by the Electrochemical Society or some combination.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't, that's not a problem at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For that particular purpose, yes.
Because I was going to object strenuously to offering the entire tapes to anybody who wanted to listen. Not because there would be anything deleterious to the society that would be edited out beforehand, but simply it might give a wrong impression if somebody had to listen for 2 hours to find something of more general interest than would pertain to people interested in, say, electrochemistry or even just interested in people.
What we have found, I've done well over 100, almost 150 interviews over the last 10 years for the Chemical Heritage Foundation. And so we have an extensive collection of tapes. And no one has ever come in and listened to the tapes. But they do come in and look at our bound reading copies, which are indexed. So I had somebody who wanted something on Linus Pauling. Well, Linus Pauling's covered... There are anecdotal stories about Pauling in 6 different interviews. You could go to the index, pull out that little piece, and that was it. That's all they had to do. You're right. Going to the tape to find it is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So our experience has been most people will look at a transcript, and you can cover 2 hours of oral and a written transcript in a very short time.
Mm-hmm. Just to be on the personal side, I think that if somebody were to listen to something about me, I would want it to be my participation in starting the monograph series for the Society. because I think it's the most important thing that I have done for the society. So that would be perhaps 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay.
And that's the sort of thing which I hope that might be made available to people.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, in order to get a good assortment of folks doing this sort of thing, or being responsible for this kind of tape, there ought to be quite a few of them. This means short ones.
Yes, I don't know what their full plans are yet, and I think they're still developing. But
oh, they're very fluid at this stage.
I, as I said, I was down here anyway, so I said, well, I can come over and see you, as I saw Norman Hackerman in Texas, because I was already there. And then the next person I'm going to see is, as you probably know, is Charles Tobias.
Oh, yes.
And he was on our list to be scheduled anyways. He was to be done this year separately from ECS. So when that came along, we said, well, we're going to see him anyway, so we can talk to him as well.
You'll enjoy that.
That's what I've been told.
Yes. Charles is one of my favorite people.
Everybody has spoken very highly of him.
Yes.
And Paul Milner is, of course, on our board, representing your society, and he and I have had some very lengthy discussions, and of course his name came up many times.
Well, Paul and I get together very frequently at meetings. We enjoy each other.
Yes, I've enjoyed my interactions with Paul. Is there anything else you wanted in the way of preliminary questions?
If so, I've forgotten.
Okay.
Which is I'm very, very capable of doing these days. Okay, go ahead.
Well, let's begin then by indicating today is March 22nd, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Harold J. Reed at his home in Grove City, Florida. Dr. Reed, I know that you were born in Dubuque, Iowa on 14th of February, 1911. Could you just tell me a little bit about your parents and your family background?
Well, I can tell you fairly precisely about my paternal background, because it's Irish. And my paternal grandfather and grandmother emigrated from Ireland as youngsters, separately, in different families, and were married in this country in 1857, which goes back quite a ways.
Yes.
And so I have Irish background on the paternal side. On the maternal side, as far as I know, my ancestors there welcomed the Indians when they came to North America. In other words, I have no idea of when the family came to America. The family name on my mother's side was Taylor, which indicates, of course, English background. And other than that, I know relatively little, in fact, almost nothing, about my family background. I've not been much interested in genealogy. What I've learned has largely been through the efforts of cousins, rather than my own efforts. My father was a carpenter, and my mother had a very, very interesting occupation for a woman. He was a compositor for the Galena Gazette, a newspaper, but probably the only one they ever had as a woman. And she was there some 10 years or so before she married my father. So, but
you said Galena.
She had only a high school education, which in those days, which would be the early 1900s, high school was considered a pretty high. I mean, did I say high school education? I was wrong. Eighth grade,
okay.
At that time, the eighth grade education was about equivalent to our present high school education, because they spent most of their time learning rather than playing instruments in the band or whatnot. Now, actually, my folks left Dubuque when I was 6 months old, so I'm not much of an Iowan. And we moved to Galena, which is up in the northwestern corner of Illinois, very high, hilly area, and an old mining area for blackjack, which is lead zinc ore. And after that, we just moved around and around. How much of this sort of thing do you want?
Well, I'd like to go through a little bit of your childhood and where your interest in chemistry developed.
Okay. All right. My father suffered financial reverses in the early 20s. He extended too much credit to farmers and got caught in the panic of 21. This changed things quite a lot for me, because I had gone to a country school where I was the only student in my grade. When my father entered his bankruptcy, we had to leave the town where we were then living and move to Galena, which was the county seat of Judge Davis County. The whole new world opened up to me there, because there was a library in the little community where we had lived previously, which was named Woodbine. There was just nothing at all. So the Carnegie Library in Galena was not only a revelation, but a grand one. And I began more and more to enjoy school. We left Galena when I had finished seventh grade and moved to Crystal Lake, Illinois, northwestern suburb of Chicago. And this was a wholly different community, about the same size as Galena, perhaps a little smaller, but it was a summer resort town in those days. And at the time I was ready to enter high school, the community had built a new community high school to take care of not only Crystal Lake, but Fox River Grove and Cary, two small towns to the south. The tax situation in Crystal Lake was a little odd. Most of the residents were summer residents, but had very considerable properties, some of them quite elegant, on which they paid taxes, of course. As a result, the community had a plethora of tax money. And when the community high school was built, they did it up brown. It was a beautiful piece of work. But most importantly, they engaged a gentleman named Dean as superintendent. And he had what I consider one of the most wonderful ideas for a school superintendent. Namely, that all of the instructors should have their degrees in the material that they were going to teach, and to hell with education courses. Well, take care of the law. It required a certain amount of formal education courses. But Mr. Dean insisted that what was important was the subject matter. We had marvelous instructors, just wonderful. Well, my interest in electrochemistry started, not surprisingly, in the course in chemistry that I had in this high school, whose laboratory was better equipped than the freshman laboratories at the University of Illinois. We had excellent equipment, and everybody had all they wanted. Well, we are also encouraged to do a thesis. This was in 1923 and 1928. And Colin Fink's patent on chromium plating had just issued. So I decided for my project I would see whether or not this patent worked. And I was able to get a copy of the patent. And lo and behold, I ran some experiments, plated some material, and it worked. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Fink telling him of my experience. Never had a reply. He was able to get along on his own. But
how did you find this? How did you come across this patent as something you were interested in?
My instructor,
I see,
suggested that I might be interested in it. Just why he did it, I don't know. But incidentally, he's still alive. He's well along in his 90s and on his fourth wife. Remarkable man. Well, in any event, that was my original interest in electrochemistry. If we could go. Incidentally, I graduated as valedictorian of my class, which was not a very big one, and that gave me a scholarship to the University of Illinois, which is my main reason for going to Illinois rather than to a nearby college in the Chicago area. At that time, of course, there was no division of the University of Illinois.
Well, you must have started right after the college, right after the Depression started. When did you go to Illinois, 1930?
Before the Depression.
Oh.
I was entered as a freshman in fall of 28.
Okay.
So I got caught in the Depression.
Okay.
And that was the reason for me interrupting my education. Because my father was still recovering from his financial problems. And although I could stay at home, free board and room, he couldn't offer me anything else. So I had earned money one way or another, and did 1 year at the university and ran out of money. Also, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I had enrolled in chemical engineering. So I had a variety of jobs and went back to school for 2 years. I still wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I changed to chemistry because I early became convinced that I didn't want to be an engineer. And so I dropped out again. And this time I got into something quite interesting. After some more or less miscellaneous jobs, as the legislative season of 1933 came on, a friend of our family was responsible for legislative reporting section of Commerce Clearinghouse. Commerce Clearinghouse is the publishing part of the Corporation Trust Company. And Mr. Hewling, who was the head of that section, needed a great deal of additional assistance when the legislators started meeting. At that time, almost all the legislators met in alternate years, and almost all of them in the odd years. So when 1933 came along, he needed a great deal of additional help. So I was hired for that. In those days, the legislators lasted no longer than their salary, which was usually as short as possible, namely about 2 months. So when the legislators finished their work, our jobs were over, except mine. For some reason or other, the president of Commerce Clearinghouse decided to try an experiment. The State and Local Tax Service in those days had 13 editors, all of whom were lawyers. He decided that he would like to try somebody who wasn't a lawyer as an editor for that service. And apparently my editorial work for the Legislative Reporting Service had gone pretty well. So I was invited to become an editor in State and Local Tax Service. Well, since I needed money, needed a job, I accepted. And, well, things went pretty well. And I earned enough money then, sure, going back to school to finish my first degree. And I decided chemistry was still it. Incidentally, I was offered a job with the Commerce Clearinghouse of editing their house magazine, which would have been a stepping stone to management. It was quite a temptation to continue, but I decided that science had more attractions than the law. In fact, some aspects of the law repelled me pretty badly. Well, I went back to Illinois, and of course, now that I had a fair amount of money saved, I found there was no trouble in getting a job. But I can go back a little bit. Am I being too wordy?
No, it's fine.
To go back a little bit, when I was a freshman at college, I took my meals at a boarding club, which was quite the thing to do in those days. And one of the group was a senior who was working on his thesis in chemistry with Frank Howard and Sherlock Swan. Frank Howard was a non-entity, pleasant chap, but a non-entity. Sherlock Swan, of course, had a great deal to do with the Electrochemical Society, very well known in electroorganic chemistry. Well, the chap that I'm referring to, the senior, I can't remember his name, but he broke his wrist. And part of his activity was metallographic activity, which involves polishing specimens, which are held by hand. He was right-handed, and his broken wrist was right-handed. He was desperate on what to do. Well, I'd had such a good background in high school that college was never much of a problem to me. So I offered to see if I could polish his specimens for him, which I did. And became very much interested in what he was doing, which was electroorganic reduction. And also very much interested in his reaction to Sherlock Swan. So when it came time for me some years later to choose a thesis subject for my bachelor's degree, and in those days Illinois required a thesis for a BA, I went around to Dr. Swan, he was Dr. Swan to me then, to see if he had something that would suit me and whether I could suit him. Well, we came to an agreement, and I did my senior thesis with him to such an interesting result that I did my master's thesis with him too. So this is how I got into electroorganic chemistry. Of course, I rather soon got out of it because after the master's degree at Illinois, I could have stayed there. with an assistantship, but I wanted to go someplace else. And Sherlock was very much in agreement. I remember him saying that he would dearly love to have me stay on and continue sort of interest in things we were doing, but in all good conscience, he could only advise me to see if I could find something of interest elsewhere, just to broaden my background, broaden my experience. Happily, I was able to get a assistant instructorship at Penn.
Why Penn? Was that Edgar Foss Smith legacy in electrochemistry there yet? He died in 28, I think.
No, it was Hiram Lukens.
Okay.
Hiram Lukens was very active in the Electrochemical Society, and Sherlock Swan had already gotten quite active, although he was still a relatively young man. And Sherlock felt that I could get along well with Hiram Lukens, and that the atmosphere there would be good for me. Well, it turned out differently, because Edgar Foss Smith retired, and Hiram took over as head of the chemistry department and was too busy in his new activity to take on graduate students. As a result, I did my thesis with Martin Kilpatrick, and on a subject which was really more metallurgy than chemistry: behavior of passage of gases through metallic membranes. That's how I got more and more into metallurgy. When I finished up my PhD at Penn, I again decided that I had to go someplace else. Although I could have stayed at Penn, in fact, I was already an instructor rather than an assistant. I was offered a good job there. But Hiram told me that much as he would like to, he couldn't promise fast promotion, simply because of the way things worked at Penn. You just had to take your chances. The chances didn't look too good. So that's why I went to Mellon Institute.
Okay.
That's sort of a halfway measure between industry and academic.
Had you thought about industrial jobs at that point?
Not seriously, no.
Okay.
Except at Mellon Institute, it was really an industrial job. It was the fellowship that I worked with. And you know how Mellon works.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's very different than Battelle. Well, the fellowship that I was with was H.H. Robertson, and they're builders or makers of heavy builders materials, but they were wanting to diversify because the building material industry
mm-hmm.
up and down. Well, so my assignment there was simply to get interested in something different than what we're making now and see what you can do. Very interesting. That's why I accepted the job. So I had a very pleasant 5 years, technically. But I ran into problems with the patent attorney. We just didn't see eye to eye. And I felt that I was being badly used and neglected. So I was eager to leave when the opportunity came to go to Penn State. Incidentally, I had a very, very pleasant 5 years in Pittsburgh. I enjoyed it very much. And part of it came from the place where we lived. We lived right on the edge of the Carnegie Tech campus. And my neighbors, a chemist, a metallurgist, playwright, two mathematicians. That's the sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Very pleasant. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, I'm the last survivor of that community. Mm. Just a few days ago, I received a death notice from the only other one. Time goes by. Well, I told you why I left Mellon Institute. Of course, I was there during the war here.
If I could, just for the war years, there was a period there where you, because of your metalworking, which I'm assuming I saw your shop out here, which is very impressive, but and so I'm assuming you've had that interest for a long time, but you did some work for the Atomic Energy Commission during the war. Is that correct?
Yes, but most of it was for the Manhattan Project.
Okay.
Also, we did quite a bit for Army Ordnance and a little bit for Navy. The way things went, and I'll try to make it reasonably brief, next door neighbor was Max Gensler, a professor of mechanical metallurgy at Carnegie Tech. And after the war got underway, he got mixed up with Houdai Hershey and their gun tube extrusion plant out in Illinois. It used to be that gun tubes were made by piercing billet. Well, Houdai Hershey decided to make them by extrusion, at least up to 75 millimeter. And Max got involved in the mechanical properties of the resulting steel tubes. And as a result, had a great many tensile specimens shipped to him for testing and evaluation of the results. Well, in Pittsburgh, if you want somebody to machine a great huge roll, 25 tons or so, down to the proverbial gnat's eyebrow, that everybody in town wants to do it. But if you have a little bitty something, like a tensile specimen, nobody's interested. So Max had a lot of trouble, and he knew that I had a lathe in my basement, and asked me if I could please make a few specimens for him, because he just desperately needed them. So I made about 24, and apparently they were all right. So then there was 24, and then there were more. Well, my wife was quite adept manually. So I taught her how to run the lathe, and she started making the specimens. And then they came in by the hundreds. And she told me one day that she spent too much time watching what was going on. If she had two lathes, she can keep them both going. And so you find two lathes out there. And eventually you start making Sharpie Izod specimens. And so I got a milling machine for that, and she was running two lathes and a milling machine and reading detective stories on the side. Well, that's the reason for the shop.
Okay.
And when we got into the Manhattan, incidentally, we did so much of that I had to set up a company because of some problems. And we started doing work then for Army Ordnance, Navy Ordnance, Atomic Energy Commission. And again, my whole workforce was Catherine. I did work in the evening, and particularly grinding tools. Well, the Manhattan Project came along, and Max got involved in that. And One of the problems was what happens to the graphite in a pile. The reactors were known as piles then. So it was Mac's job to find out. Well, we wanted to compare natural graphite with some varieties of manufactured graphite. Where to get the natural graphite? So I undertook to take specimens out of the back of display specimens from the Carnegie Institute. So I presume that still, if you look at the specimens of natural graphite in the Carnegie Institute in Pittsburgh, that you'll find them looking perfectly natural. But if you could turn them over, you'd find a hole in the back of each one. Well, that was the sort of thing that I did. And it got to the point where I had to design, or we needed to design, equipment that was different to anything available. So I got into equipment design and the manufacturing prototype. That's why I have so much equipment. When I went to Penn State, equipment came along with me for the most part. And for a while I operated this instrument making company. But I got too involved in both professorial activities and in consulting work, which I enjoyed much more than the business that was involved in the instrument making activity. Also, there was a limitation on what I could do with the instrument business without getting into a good deal of paperwork, which I detested. So, but I kept the machinery. Well, that's some of the background.
But when you were in Philadelphia, you were associated with a consulting company at Kenneth Graham and Associates?
Yes. This came about through having offices close together. When I first entered graduate work at Penn, I was assigned to an office that was right next door, or nearly so, to Ken Graham's office. And we visited back and forth and found much of mutual interest. And this is what got me back into electroplating. You may remember that I verified Fink's patent mm-hmm. in high school and had never done any more electroplating after that until Ken got me interested in electrodeposition. And together we devised some experiments on what was happening at cathode during electrodeposition. And I made the gadgetry and did the work, and we published some material together. And we got so interested that during the summer recess, he offered me a job at his little research laboratory out in Jenkintown. And that worked out very well. And we became personal friends as well as more or less scientific friends. And I met my wife at a Christmas dinner at Ken's home. So our connection got ever closer.
Mm-hmm.
And in due course, well, of course, we became brothers-in-law and law. So that's how I got into the Graham activity. After the that was completely interrupted during the war. But after the war, Ken and a chap named Crowley, Clyde Crowley, from Chicago, got together to form Graham Crowley and Associates with offices in Jenkintown, which is a suburb of Philadelphia, as you probably know, and other offices in Chicago, Crowley in Chicago, Graham in Jenkintown. And they got into a diversity of activities. And Sherlock Swan and I, along with two or three others, became the associates. Got into some very, very interesting consulting work. And one of the associates, as I said, was Swan. John Baylor of the University of Illinois was another.
Yes. When you were in
the... Just a minute.
Sure.
Are you familiar with what...
No.
Well, turn your gadget off. What were we doing?
Well, what I'd like to do at this point is to start looking at your society activities going all the way back. My indication is you joined the society in 1934.
Right.
You got your bachelor's degree at Illinois. Was that unusual to be joining a, I'm going to say, a specialist society at that, after your first degree?
Yes, quite unusual.
Was that Swan's influence, I'm assuming?
Yes, Swan proselytized. Also, I should point out that I joined the American Chemical Society at the same time, within a matter of weeks. And interestingly enough, Sherlock Swan, of course, got me into the electrochem, and Speed Marvel was the one who got me into American Chemical Society. Now, they both went on to become presidents of the respective society. I consider myself the president maker.
I was going to ask you earlier that why you didn't succumb to organic chemistry at Illinois with Marvel and Adams, and that really being their strength was organic chemistry.
Well, of course, my two theses were in electro-organic. Mm-hmm. And also, I was interested in the metallurgical aspects because really what I was studying was not the reaction as a chemical reaction, but as an electrochemical reaction. The reaction I studied was just an ordinary routine one, reduction of... ketone to a hydrocarbon, and but what I studied was the effect of the cathode, metallurgical aspects or properties of the cathode.
Okay.
So I didn't really escape the organic. Well, another reason that I got teed off on electro-organic chemistry in most respects was that I worked during the summer of 1934. That would be the graduation year for my master's degree. I went on for a master's degree, but I worked during the summer for Fraser Johnstone. And his laboratory, in which I worked, was directly below the laboratory in which organic synthesis was going on. And in that year, they did everything in the world they could to make stinks. And when an organicer sets out to make stinks, that's really something. Of course, the effluvia came down, just no air conditioning. It came down out of their window and into mine. I had enough of organic stinks. My reduction was with a material which didn't stink.
When you first joined the Electrochemical Society, did you go to any meetings? Was there a chapter at Illinois? Or?
No, the closest chapter was, or section was, Chicago. I was too poor to go up, and also I was too busy. So it wasn't until I got to Penn that I got interested in society activities per se.
Okay.
There was just no opportunity or reason to do anything in Illinois.
What did your membership in 1934 entitle you to? What did you
And what did you get for it?
You got the transactions.
Okay.
Twice a year. And this is a report, of course, of what went on at the semi-annual meeting. Also, you received monthly a bulletin, which varied considerably from time to time, but was sort of a news magazine and contained some material of scientific interest alone, that is, apart from any society activities, mainly patent listings pertaining to electrochemistry and to some degree industrial activities. It was pretty much whatever Colin Fink could find time to put in it, because he edited it, and he was a remarkable man. He did it all. So there were just those two things. That's all. And the meetings, which I got into quite early. When I went to Penn, the first meeting to be held after I got there was in Washington, which was quite wild. But I was still too poor to go. So Hiram Lookins loaned me enough money to attend the meeting. I was very, very favorably impressed, not only with scientific aspects of the meeting, but also the people. And I'll take one example that I'll never forget. You probably have heard of Charles Burgess, mm-hmm. Burgess Battery. He was still alive and still fairly active in 1935. And I remember still going down to breakfast one morning and standing in line. The gentleman back of me asked if I were alone. He had seen my little badge and a member of the society, and I said yes. Well, it turned out to be Charles Burgess. He asked me to join him for breakfast. And it was a wonderful experience to have an hour or so with mm-hmm. him, mm-hmm. and unhappily he died not too long after that. But that was typical of the way youngsters were treated by the older members of the society, for the most part. There were some crusty ones too. You always have to dilute things. So Hiram Lupin's always a little careful with his money, and while I hope he was sure that he would be repaid, he helped things along by getting me jobs translating German patents for a firm of patent attorneys in Philadelphia. So I was not only able to pay him back, but also to begin courting the girl who became my wife.
Was there a section in Philadelphia?
Yes.
At the time?
Yes, there was. And I've forgotten which year I was elected secretary, but it was very soon after I moved to Philadelphia. And apparently I did a good job, because instead of putting me up the ladder to become chairman, they kept me on as secretary, probably for two reasons. I haven't mentioned it before, but I looked much, much younger than I actually was, and I suspect that maybe this is one reason they didn't want me to become chairman. But in any event, they kept electing me secretary until I left. And I got involved quite a few things. And
how big a group was it?
I don't remember. I would judge maybe 50 members, of whom perhaps 25 or 30 attended meeting quite regularly. It couldn't have been much larger, because we met in the old Lenape Club, and for dinner. And that, the dining room there was not large. Then we moved to the old Harrison Laboratory for meeting itself. Sometimes the meetings were quite well attended by people other than members of the society, because we were able, I shouldn't say we, the section was able to attract well-known scientists through personal contacts and so on. There's Hiram Lukens and Milton Barbey of trying to think of the instrument makers in Philadelphia. Well, in any event, we had Milton Barbey, George Perley of well, I just can't think of the name of the instrument company, but they had extensive connections with scientists all over the country, and helped a great deal in bringing us people of outstanding ability and men who were interesting.
Were most of the members of the section industrial people as opposed to the academics like Lukens?
I think that there was probably a majority of industrial people, but not a big one, because there were quite a few institutions in Philadelphia that had some interest in electrochemistry. There was Jerry Craik at Swarthmore.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember who was at Temple. Oh, Sam Hyman at Temple. And also, there was a fair amount of interest in coming to electrochem meetings, because we didn't limit ourselves to electrochemists for our speakers. The general idea was that we ought to be interested in science, and particularly science that had some connection, sometimes very vague, to electrochemistry. And one of the things that I'll say about the society, and perhaps elaborate on in terms of some of your topics, was the diversity of interests, diversity of activities in the society. One of the things that kept me there. Now, I was a member of the Chemical Society, the American Chemical Society's section in Philadelphia. But I found it much more rewarding to be active in the electrochem. Same thing, not the same thing. To a considerable degree, the same kind of thing prevailed in Pittsburgh, where again I chose the Electrochem Society, and there was a section there. Over the American Chemical Society's branch or section, which it was called. Simply, I enjoyed the diversity of electrochem. Now, it's true that there's much diversity in the American Chemical Society, and becoming more and more so, but it isn't as diverse as things that go on in the Electrochemical Society. There are times when I wonder whether or not the society ought not to be called the Society of Potpourri.
What was the relationship between, if there was any, between the Electrochemical Society section and the American Chemical Society section in Philadelphia?
Outside of members that belong to each, I don't
there
remember
was,
anything.
Okay.
Remember, of course, this is quite a few years ago. And
well, the reason I asked that question is that the ECS originated because of disagreements within the ACS.
And to some degree, yeah.
There was some ill feelings, I guess, between certain people, and that ACS didn't start an electrochemistry group, and therefore the ECS went its own way.
I've heard different versions of that.
That's why I was asking just whether any of those feelings still carried on, but...
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
And I did get quite deeply involved in the Electrochemical Society activities in Philadelphia, even though I was still a youngster. I guess because... sometimes I would do things other people didn't.
What kinds of things were you doing there? I guess as secretary, you sort of controlled things that went on, didn't you?
Yes, pretty much. Well, an specific example was the meeting which was held at Wernersville. The 1930. I think it was the 1939 or 38 meeting was to be held by the carried out by the Philadelphia section, and we elected to have the venue in a resort up in the mountains, namely at Wernersville. Wernersville is 16 miles from nowhere, but a very, very nice resort hotel with good facilities, and we thought it was easy to get to because we were close by. It's just outside of Reading. Well, at that time, the chairman was Crenshaw. Not Ballard Kinwood. What's the school out there? Girls' school. Let's forget the name of it.
I should know. I can't think of it either.
It'll come to me when it's of no consequence. In any event, Al Crenshaw was chairman and supposed to be running things. Well, at the planning meeting, he didn't show up. And the treasurer and I were the two officials there. The treasurer was Al Ware, and Al Ware knew absolutely nothing about electrochemistry. But he published transactions. He was a printer. And he was a perennial treasurer of the section, and a swell fellow. Well, he had never been to a meeting, had no idea what to do. So, of course, it was my job to run the planning meeting. And apparently I did a fairly good job. The meeting went off very well. If you want to more about it, there's a write-up about it, which I wrote. In Interface.
Okay.
Folks in the society of recent years have been asking me to write reminiscences, which I have done, with only a moderate amount of prosaic license.
Were you doing anything on the national scene while you were in Philadelphia, or was it mostly local?
It started in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And with appointment to a publication committee. I'll take that back. We started work on modern electroplating while I was still in Philadelphia. The meeting at which all of those papers was presented was in Chicago in the fall of 41. But we had started work at least 2 years before. So I must have started work nationally then in Philadelphia about 1938-39. And the specific activity was in working on the editorial committee for modern electroplating, which turned out to be the first monograph published by the Society after some developments, which I think I'll talk about a little bit later.
Okay.
So I did get involved nationally in that way. And apparently things worked out pretty well for me. And modern electroplating did all right, too. And I've never made much of a point of this publicly, but I did most of the editorial work, largely because I had more experience in editorial work than any other member on the editorial committee. Their main job was selecting authors for the various chapters of modern electroplating, and then deciding whether or not the submitted manuscripts fulfilled the directives and whether or not material there was suitable and acceptable. But I edited practically everything as far as the mechanics of editing, putting down the scribbles in the margin and so on. And also I did the first galleys before passing them on to the authors. Because most authors don't know really how to work up galleys. And I had done so much of it with Commerce Clearing House that it was no problem.
Now there was a division of electrodeposition that started, or was it you were involved with? I guess this is right after you went to Pittsburgh. No, this is still when you were in Philadelphia, according to what I have here. You were chairman in 42.
Yes. Now, the electrodeposition division, of course, was an old one within the society. Yes. I became secretary first in Pittsburgh, I think in 41, the year after I arrived there. And apparently I get elected secretary any place I go. But then went on to become chairman. And this was during the time that I was editing Modern Electroplating, because the papers were presented in the fall of 41, and I didn't edit the material for the transactions. That was done by Colin Flynn. But I re-edited the things, really. For modern electroplating. So, wait a minute. No, I'll take that back. I edited the papers for the meeting.
Okay.
And Colin didn't have to do anything with them except approve for publication in the transactions. And I reworked them to some degree for publication as modern electroplating. And of course added four material and what I always called ass end material. So Most of that editorial work was done in both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh.
When you got to Pittsburgh, then, you were also and became eventually chairman of the Pittsburgh section as well. How would you compare the Pittsburgh section with the Philadelphia section?
It was much more industrial. Although there were good leaders in the academic area, too. And some of them became presidents of the society, Francis Frary with Alcoa, and Jake Warner with Carnegie Tech. And when I think back, mainly industrial people that were active in the society. Because Westinghouse and Alcoa were the ringleaders of the Pittsburgh section. And incidentally, it's the reason the Pittsburgh section fell apart, is because the people in Westinghouse and Alcoa changed complexion. Now, I should say that the companies changed complexion. But there's people like Francis Frary with Alcoa, John Martin with Westinghouse, Sidney Barnett with Westinghouse, and there was a Norwegian chap who was very active in society but never became president. I'm sorry that sometimes I forget.
Oh, that's all right.
I'm getting very good at it.
You had mentioned earlier how good Swan was at proselytizing. Was anybody in the Pittsburgh or Philadelphia section doing that with students?
Jake Warner, yes.
Okay.
And to a degree, Paul Fugassi. You won't find much about Paul Fugassi in anywhere, except in some few very, very erudite publications. He was a teacher, first and foremost, and a thinker. He published very rarely, but he was also a very fine gentleman. And between Jake Warner and Paul Fugassi, we had quite a few students who joined during the 5 years that I was there. However, to some degree, of course, you must remember it was war years, and the number of students was small.
Where was Fugassi? Was he at Carnegie Tech
Carnegie
also?
Carnegie Tech, yes, in chemistry.
Was there anything else about the Pittsburgh era? We've talked a little bit about, you got out on the publication committee, and that was right after you left Pittsburgh, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
No, I was on the publication committee while I was still in Pittsburgh, but I became chairman after I moved to Penn State.
Okay. What was the committee like when you joined it? And how were you appointed to that committee? Were you elected to it?
Appointed.
By whom?
By the then president.
Okay.
All members of committees in the Electrochemical Society, with a few exceptions, are appointed. The exceptions are that the chairman of Ways and Means and some other committees are the vice presidents, and their chairmanship is mandated by the Constitution or bylaws. All others are appointed. Now, this is committee members I'm talking mm-hmm. about. The board of directors, of course, is quite different. That's elected. I think you asked about the publication committee. It was me, to put it bluntly.
Okay.
Nobody else did any work. And the committee was relatively inactive. I tried to stir some things up, and maybe some of the things that came to pass might at least have been influenced by that story. because I felt that the committee ought to be doing more in publications. We have very strong opposition from Colin Fink, who was the perennial secretary of the society, very powerful. I got nowhere at all. It was only after the revolution, so to speak, when other things, other people took over, that we got some place with publication. Although we put our foot in the door with modern electric lighting.
That was the first?
That was the first monograph.
Okay. What kind of charge did that committee have at that time?
As far as I can recall, it was very vague, and I can't recall it.
Okay.
I can recall simply that, well, the chairman was a member of the board of directors, and maybe that was the only reason for having a publication committee meeting. No, actually, it was very weak. And I was had hoped I could do something about it, but I wasn't able to.
But at least you got the monograph series.
Yes.
And that was your idea, that monograph series?
No, the idea of the symposium which led up to it was Dick Hull's. And he was the ringleader and chairman of the electrodeposition division at the time, about 1938. And the initial publication of the papers presented at the meeting were the transactions, the routine transactions, mm-hmm. which were the semi-annual publication of the semi-annual meetings. And the volume for the Chicago 41 meeting contained not only all of the papers of the electroplating symposium, but also some other general papers that filled out the meeting agenda. Well, the transactions came only to members and were not offered for general sale. But there was a tremendous demand for the papers that constituted what had been simply the symposium on electroplating. And well, all of us as a group thought that we ought to publish a monograph. Fink and some others on the board of directors were very much opposed because the society would have to risk the cost of publishing, with no guarantee, of course, of return. Ed Baker, who had been a member of the editorial committee for the electroplating symposium, was very much in favor of publishing a monograph. And he was the president of the society at the time. He forced it through as a board of directors activity or approval of publishing the monograph. Of course, it turned out to be a money maker, and really a money maker. The opposition to monographs in the board of directors disappeared completely, including Colin Fink. So after that, there was no trouble. The next monograph was Herb Ulick's Corrosion Handbook, which was a monumental effort. And it was published, unhappily, in my regard, by Wiley. Because, of course, once the publishing people had noticed that modern electroplating was selling like the proverbial stuff, they came around wanting to become publisher for the Electroplating Society. And Wiley succeeded in persuading the board of directors to enter into an agreement for a series of monographs to be published by Wiley. When the time came for the second edition of Modern Electroplating, because we had always envisioned a new edition every 10 years to keep it up to date. So when the time came, And Wiley was now the Monograph publisher. And they engaged Alan He became a director of publications for ASM and held that for many years. Damn it. This is critical, so I'll take this to one.
Sure.
Alan Gray. Alan Gray was selected by Wiley to edit the next edition of Modern Necroplay. Notice I said the next edition. Well, when they brought it out, there was no mention of the first edition. It was listed as following the Corrosion Handbook in the series. And the Corrosion Handbook came out in 48, whereas, of course, the Modern Electroplating came out in 42. Well, of course, we were absolutely outraged. And well, nothing came of the outrage. But that's why a lot of people were confused about the order of appearance as publications between Modern Electroplating and the Corrosion Handbook, including Bob Frankenthal. I remember Bob introduced the recipient of one of the awards of the society, and referred to modern to the Corrosion Handbook as the first monograph of the society. Of course, I was outraged. But he had just taken what appeared in the flyleaf in the format of Wiley's publication. Well, incidentally, I think that the issue of Interface, which will appear this month, has the story of the monograph.
Oh, okay.
So you can check what I'm saying now with what I wrote for that.
All right.
Are you familiar with Interface?
I'm not a member of the society.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well,
I am a chemist, but I'm not an electrochemist.
Well, Interface is the members' magazine for, and in a way, somewhat, but quite different from the old bulletin. The bulletin disappeared when the journal came along. But that's another story.
You essentially then left the publications committee around 1950?
I left it before that because I became only an ex officio member of the committee as editor of, technical editor of the journal.
The journal, okay.
So I was the technical editor cannot be the chairman of the publications committee. So I have had no connection with the publication committee since 1949, except once in a while they asked me to sit in with them.
I know we talked about this earlier, but I don't know if we had the dates down as to when you were technical editor for the journal.
It was 49 and 50.
Okay. And that's when you turned it over to Norman Hackerman.
Yeah. Yeah.
What did technical editor mean?
That we did everything with the journal except about two pages.
Okay.
The technical editor, there was an editor originally. And really all that he did was to write the editorial, which appeared in the formatter. All the rest of it was the responsibility of the technical editor. So that's the technical editor really was the editor. And in due course, not very soon, but in due course, the board of directors realized this and abolished the term technical director, and simply had did I say technical director? I meant technical editor, and simply had editor of the journal.
What kind of acceptance rate did you have on papers at that time?
I can't remember. I just can't remember. That's too long ago. After all, that's 54 years.
I know.
44 years. Well, I just can't remember. Well, if it might well be that there are records in society, but I would hate to try to find them.
Did you?
Maybe I can answer it in a general way.
Okay.
I don't recall that we had very many rejections, because there were lots of new things going on, and people were getting into new areas. And the papers that were being offered for publication and were so often new material that you didn't care how bad they were. You were delighted when they were good, but if they weren't so good, you fixed them up and published them anyway. A specific example was the matter of fluorescent materials. The Electrochemical Society was the leading publisher of the material, of the work that was going on in ceramics, really, of investigating fluorescent materials. It ended up here and there. I was heavily criticized because I published, while I was editor, some materials that were just out and out ceramics. They just didn't have any connection with electroplating, or with electrochemistry. Except that I was advised by Weil, Waldemar Weil, that this was going to be an area which was going to be connected with a lot of things, including chemistry, as something very different from ceramics. Waldemar Weil was at Penn State as director of a research project or activity sponsored by a consortium of glass manufacturers. And very peculiar chap, but brilliant.
Why?
So he supported me.
Okay. Why would these people be submitting papers of that kind to you?
There's no place else for them.
Okay, they're being rejected elsewhere.
And also they were activated by bombardment. Mm-hmm. That was really the connection. Because even these are, of course, activated by bombardment.
Well, as you said earlier, what impressed you about the society was its diversity.
Yes. And always has been. Right from the very first meeting, that has been my reaction to the society and a reason for becoming active in it. And continuing to this day, I'm not active at all professionally anymore. Haven't been since I retired in 71. Except that I follow things. Mm-hmm. And the Electrochemical Society has so many branches that it's the place to follow things.
Perhaps we should look at... I want to wait before we get to your term as president of the society, but... on this list, the pre-presidential society activities, we've talked about local sections and divisions, publications. You were also on awards, several award committees.
On a lot of them. In fact, I just can't remember them all.
Okay. Is there anything particular about those committees? Were the types of nominations you got pretty good nominations, or did you have to go asking for nominations?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
to some degree, it depended on the award. For instance, there was one called the Raber Award, a rather minor one. You had to fish for those. But a major award, like the Palladium Medal and so on, no problem. Mm-hmm. We've got plenty of them, at least in those days. I understand they're encountering difficulty nowadays. I think largely because there are so many awards. And 14, 50 years ago, there were very few awards that were substantial in terms of both prestige and money.
Mm-hmm. So the society has a larger number of awards now, is that what you're saying?
I was saying that the scientific community as a whole.
Oh, is it? Okay, all right.
Including the Electrochemical Society. Yes, we have far more awards. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons has been publication, because the various sections of the society have become rich, because royalties from the monographs arranged by the various sections and groups accrue in part to the society in general, but in the majority to the group that sponsored it and responsible for the publication. And this is spread not only to monographs but to proceedings and to special publications of one sort or another. Incidentally, I've forgotten how much modern electroplating brought in, but years ago, the Corrosion Handbook had brought in over $40,000 to the society and to the Corrosion Division. The Corrosion Division takes care of awards running around $5,000 and doesn't feel it in their treasury. It's been a bit of a problem. You have to watch the IRS.
Yes. Yes, I wonder if you're still non-profit when you're building up those reserves.
It has been a source of considerable planning on the society's part to keep the nose clear. When we're starting this tape, I'm beginning to feel dry. I need something to drink. I'm going to have a beer, and I can offer you a beer or iced tea or coffee or whatnot.
Since I still have a long drive ahead, I'll take the iced tea.
Okay.
There's a lot of general type questions. Maybe what we should do now is go to that period of the 1960s when you became president, starting with number 7, and then we could maybe work through the other questions below that. But why did you want to be president?
Well, I can't ever remember that I wanted to.
Okay.
Well, a little more specifically, I hadn't really thought much about the presidency. But when I was asked by the nomination committee if I would accept the nomination for vice president, which is the first step, would I accept? Because that's a part of our society rules. Nominees must indicate their acceptance. Well, actually, I took a fair amount of time in making a decision. I decided finally that I would like to do it, and sort of halfway hoped that I wouldn't win the election, because there are always at least two candidates for the vice presidency. Well, I accepted, and I had to justify the amount of time that it would take. I was very busy as a consultant. And also, I was extremely active in the university affairs, particularly with the university senate, to which my colleagues repeatedly re-elected me. And I wasn't sure that I could properly divide myself up amongst these activities. But finally decided that I could, and I'm glad that I did, because it turned out to be an interesting and rewarding experience, and not too big a drain on my time. So I didn't go into it, let's say, without thinking it over in detail. Of course, I knew what was involved because I had been active in this, that, and the other activity of the society for so long that I knew what the story was. What I didn't know was that our then executive director was going to die while I was vice president. Because one of the reasons that I accepted the invitation to be a nominee was that I knew that the executive, he was called simply the secretary in those days, but he was an executive secretary. I knew him well, I knew he was capable, and I knew that he would do most of the work. In fact, all of it, really. Then he died of a heart attack while I was still vice president. So, fortunately, Ernie Yank offered to take over the job as secretary. That was a lifesaver because I knew Ernie very well. He was a Philadelphia man. I knew his capability. I knew he had time. I knew he had the interest. So I was safe. But it would have been a very difficult situation if the society had elected to choose somebody with whom I couldn't work well.
Did you have any agenda at the time? Did you think there was something specific you wanted to accomplish during that period?
I can't recall really that I did. The society seemed to be going along quite well because there's been a fair amount of reorganization, and things had been changing, and I was interested mainly in ensuring that our publication policy, well, to put it bluntly, was what I liked. And since they seemed to be going in that direction, my main thought was, well, let's keep it going that way. And the direction in which it was going was to make the society more of a simple reporting, a reporter of our meeting activities, and more a place for publication of material of interest in a wide field. And I think that maybe I made a little contribution in this direction, sort of continuing how I had felt as the technical editor in the initial days of the journal. I think that if I had, say, gone on and on in this activity, things might have gone a little differently than they have now, but maybe not too much. One of the things that I was concerned with was electrochemical technology. It was a publication which was started to take care of material which was more practical, more industrially oriented than the core of material that came to us in one way or another. Unfortunately, it turned out that while the publication was a success initially, it suffered from the death of a critical editor, Al Newton. He was holding it together. When he died, the editorial board or committee or who, what, editorial? No, the board of directors through the publication committee included electrochemical technology under Norm Hackamond, who was already editor of the journal. I think this was a serious mistake. Norm did an excellent job with the journal, no doubt about that. I don't think he was equally interested in electrochemical technology. Norm is not an industrial man at all, quite the opposite. And he just wasn't interested in electrochemical technology. And it fell by the wayside. And I was the one who killed him. Inasmuch as I was chairman of the committee which recommended discontinuing the journal. I hated doing it. In fact, the three of us who constituted the committee hated what we suggested had to be done. We just didn't like it. We didn't see any way out. There was running into too much money. And there seemed to be no way of finding an editor who would really do the job that Al Newman did. And so now the three people who recommended discontinuing it were Charlie Faust, a long-time member of the society and past president, and Rolf Schaefer, again a long-time member and past president. Both of them very active in the society. Charlie Faust was at Mattel, and Rolf Schaefer was an industrial man. So we had me as an academic and Charlie Faust as an institutional member and Ralph as an industrial member of the committee. I was the one who appointed the committee with myself as chairman, and intentionally I kept it very small, just the three of us. Mm-hmm. As I was well aware, if we got Tom, Dick and Harry and all the cousins, that we would just go on and on and on and probably never arrive at any very good solution. And things worked out. We just discontinued the magazine or journal with really no problems. And only a very, very small amount of recrimination by those who felt otherwise than we did. That was actually my main activity during my presidency, was dealing with electrochemical technology. Apart from that, I can't really remember anything that was much of a problem. Things went pretty routinely, with Ernie Enck taking over as secretary, because he had been a member of the society so long and was so good at organizing things. And he, although he was a chemist by profession, he was really much more of a businessman by reality. And that's exactly what we needed. So he took over things, made life very easy for the president, at least for me.
Did you have to travel a lot during that year?
During the vice presidency. The custom in the society is that the vice presidents, of whom there are three, will divide up the sections amongst themselves.
Okay.
And visit each of the sections once. That means that each vice president doesn't have to do the whole bunch, he does just a third of them. So there was that travel. Of course, I had to travel from State College to New York for board of directors meetings. But that was easy. It was, of course, by train in those days, but there was no problem at all. And I traveled so much as a consultant that a little bit more didn't make much difference. I practically commuted between Chicago and State College.
Who were you consulting for? during that time?
Graham Crowley and Associates for one, and also I was consulting for Naval Ordnance, and also for Picatinny Arsenal. Some of my work for Picatinny took me to Chicago rather than Picatinny. I did a great deal of work over the years for Naval Ordnance, and, mainly on corrosion.
Why don't we look at some of these other questions on this agenda below number 7, unless there's anything else you want to add about your year as president?
Well, actually what I'd like to add a little bit there was during the time that I was the first vice president, Ernie Yeager was the president. Do you know Ernie?
No.
Or of him? Very famous electrochemist, theoretical as all get out, at Case, back in his days, Western Reserve University. And he was an extremely active president. In fact, he did so many things that when I followed, I didn't have as many things as I might have had otherwise to take care of. But one of the things that he wanted to do was to bring the past presidents more actively into the society's activities after they had completed their presidential year. And it was he who suggested the formation of the Council of Past Presidents, which is not a very active group, but it does meet twice a year at each of the semi-annual meetings at a breakfast get-together, and the proceedings are all off the record. And the current president will be present as an invited member of the group to discuss society activities of any kind. Well, I and others thought this was a splendid idea, and to some extent it fell to me to implement it as a successor to Ernie. And the council has gone on to this day. So one of the things that I was involved in was the Council of Past Presidents. Now I am about the only one who attended the initial meetings. Unhappily, Ernie, who is still alive, is in very bad health and doesn't attend the meetings anymore. So we can pass on now.
Okay.
Am I talking too much?
No. It's fine. What was the relationship of the society to other scientific organizations? And these are sort of general during your, over the time you were associated with
it. During the time that I was president and associated closely with the society activities, I was not aware of any problems. I know that early in the life of the society, way back, there had been problems, largely because a number of people wanted to do things differently than the ACS, which is not too surprising because ACS, after all, couldn't cover everything. But I can't recall that there were any problems. And there was cooperation to some extent with the Society of Chemical Industry, with the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, and these activities consisted of appointing joint members to various committees, which still prevails to a certain extent. But I don't remember any problems. I think that in general, if some society asked us to cooperate, I can't recall if there was any problems. On the other hand, I can't recall that we ever went out seeking cooperation from other groups. We were so broad that if something new came up, we didn't ask Johnny Joe's society to take care of it. We took care of it ourselves, like the 4-H presently.
Mm-hmm.
absolutely no reason whatever for Electrochemical Society to be the main publisher and symposium arranger for the fullerenes. It's extremely hard to find any relationship at all outside of electrons. But they needed a home, and they were doing something interesting, something new, Electrochemical Society. And they're going great guns now. God.
Now that you mentioned fullerenes, what was the society's relationship with the Fleischer-Pons cold fusion type of situation?
Well, that's not an easy one. I have to be a little careful here. Well, first of all, Pons had been a recipient of the Electrochemical Society's summer scholarship and had been a member of the society for many years. There was, of course, a good deal of interest because it really, this time, it was electrochemistry, no doubt about it. Bacchus, of course, jumped into this. So did Ernie. Jaeger. But most intimately, Fritz Will, who was a past president of the Electrochemical Society, became the director of the activity out at the University of Utah, which of course brought the society directly into it. And a number of symposia were arranged over a period of a year or two by the society to look into the so-called cold fusion. And happily, the symposia were arranged such a way that opinions could be expressed without committing the society to anything, including without committing any publication at all. And those of us who were consulted at the time thought this was the thing to do. It worked out all right. So, at least the society provided a forum for discussion of this without endorsing or condemning any aspect of it. It was simply a forum. I think it was handled very well. And this has occurred on some other occasions too, particularly back in the days of arguments about mechanisms of bright plating and somewhat similar things. So, does this answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it participated as a provider of the forum without putting our fingers too deeply in the pie. I've had discussions with Fritz, whom I know very well, and I'd just soon not enter into that.
Sure. No, that's fine. What was the question number 9? What was the relationship of the society with industrial sponsors?
I think on the whole very good, but not extensive. We look upon industrial sponsors as means of financing awards. That's one thing. And to a limited extent, for some source of society income for general purposes. I have tried to interest the society in attracting more people other than industrial people as supporters of the society in this way of contributing memberships. Has worked at all. There are two of us. I happen to be one. I'm not a rich man, but I do have a comfortable income. And I'm a supporting member of the society. The other one is Joe Schumacher out in California. And we get together occasionally and congratulate each other on being contributing members and commiserating each other on our isolation. Now, but to be a little bit more serious, I don't think that I have ever encountered any real problem in the society of conflict between industrial members, industrial activities, or anything of that sort. It's surprising, really, to me how well that has gone on. And I think some indication of it is a pretty good balance between industry and academic areas on the presidency of society. I went back 70 years after reading the question, and there are 45 past presidents from industry and 25 from academic areas. I had a little trouble categorizing a couple of the past presidents, but that's, I think, a pretty good balance. Mm-hmm. Because I'm sure that our membership is vastly greater in proportion in a general way. So I think that we get along very well. And I have a feeling that this division of the presidency is a pretty good indicator.
That leads into the next question, which is the relationship between the academic and industrial contingents within the society.
This is a very difficult one. Very difficult. First of all, just what do you mean by the industrial contingents?
Well, I'm thinking of the American Chemical Society. The academic chemist and the industrial chemist are frequently far apart. With totally different interests and agendas.
Well, I thought that's what you had in mind. I've tried to formulate some kind of an answer to this, and I haven't come up with anything very good. But let me put it this way. In my experience, when I ask somebody in industry to participate in one way or another in society activities, I can't recall any problems at all. I didn't always get an acceptance. But if I had a refusal, it was always on the basis of excellent grounds. On the other hand, if I asked somebody to do something, and somebody in industry to do something, almost always it was done. In fact, I found that I got better results as far as getting things actually done when I went to people in industry than academic field. The people in academic field had too much time.
I think that's about all I can say on that particular point.
What about the relationships between the various divisions? We come to this great diversity again.
This was not always without abrasion. There was abrasion on occasion. But for the most part, things seem to have worked out pretty well. And usually it shows up in board of directors meetings, because the board of directors, under the present setup, and for quite a few years past, has comprised the chairman of the various sections, plus some other miscellaneous ones. And it is here that there is likely to be friction. And this does happen sometimes. But providing the chairman does his job, it usually doesn't amount to very much. An inept chairman, president, of course, and there have been some, may let things get out of hand. Now, the other place where abrasion can develop is in the scheduling of presentation of papers for the meetings. This is done in the society headquarters at a meeting of people involved as representatives of each of the sections, which has a symposium going on. And the society is so big that almost all of the sections, the groups, will be representative. And of course there are occasionally fights for time. On the whole, these get ironed out pretty well. And for the most part, it's the responsibility not of the president. The president doesn't even show up at these. This is where our executive secretary comes in. And to a great extent, our director of publications, which is Sally Kilfoyle. And God knows what will happen when she retires. But in any event, this is one place where some abrasion has developed. But again, it's just an immediate matter rather than policy. I think as far as policy is concerned, any problems have been ironed out pretty well between the sections themselves, or at least in the board of directors meetings. I'm surprised there hasn't been more problems because of this diversity. But maybe the fact that we are so diverse and so used to new things coinciding with each other, and it's odd how this happens from time to time, we're so used to it that there's no problem.
How has the society contributed or reacted to significant scientific events in electrochemistry and related fields?
Oh, I think this is where we shine. And to take some specific examples, as you know, in the last few years there's been considerable development on the production of diamond surfaces. I'm not thinking of what you put into the engagement ring, but diamond coated surfaces for abrasion wear, conductivity, and some other simple reasons. Here again is something very new that the society has provided a forum for, with great success, both to the society and to the people interested in this area. And this has happened time and time again. I can hark back to the fluorescent materials as another example. When bright electroplating first became an object of development, members of this society jumped right into the field and really made it. The I could think of some other examples, but and again, it's the diversity that we've had for so long that makes it possible to do this, but also the fact that we're used to it. And when the fluorines came along and people looking for a home, so to speak,
Well, we've got plenty of room.
Okay. Responsiveness of the society to members' needs. That's number 13.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you were referring to scientific needs, not to pensions, not to insurance or that sort of
thing. No, scientific.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I've tried ever since reading this, to think of some example which might be deduced here.
In other words,
really, I can't think of anything to answer to this one. The from time to time, there are some requests by members to do something about getting additional students in a specific area of electrochemistry. What can the society do to encourage students to come into some specific area of interest to some specific group? This has occurred, and something has been done about it in the way of providing published material that can be used by circulating in schools and so on. So it's one example where there was a positive contribution by the society to something that the members had felt was a problem or a need. So it has been done on the case, but not very often.
Would you classify the members then as being, I don't want to use the word happy, but satisfied with their membership and that they're getting their money's worth, if I could put it that way?
Yeah. Well, over the years, I've heard very, very few objections to the way the society operates or to the way that he or she has been treated. I know one or two, but there were screwballs in both cases. One of them, an extremely capable screwball, and the other one incapable of screwball. Yeah. Well, I'll never forget Charlie Casper, a brilliant man, offered the society four papers, extremely theoretical, in current distribution in electrolytes during electrolysis, and we published them. After a great deal of trouble, and I had quite a bit to do with it. Every time that I met Charlie after that, he would carry on, accusing me of trying to ruin his career. And not only accusing me, but others who had been responsible for getting his papers published. But this is the exception, very much the exception.
I think by comparison, ACS has on occasion gone through periods where there was more than just a few dissatisfied members. In fact, I think one president was elected at one point as a write-in. There was a movement,
what was his name?
Alan Dixon. I think that's the one who was really a grassroots level candidate.
Yeah. Nixon.
Nixon.
But
I thought you said Dixon.
I did, but I think you're right. It was Dixon.
I'm sure, yeah. Because Joe Dixon...
yes, was, I know Joe.
Yes, was for many years chairman of the board. Yeah. Yeah, it was Nixon. Yeah, he was a bit of an iconoclast. But I think on the whole that actually we the society hasn't been called on too many times to come to the rescue of the members in one way or another. But they've done what they could.
Positive and negative changes in the society.
Well, this is one that I could talk on all afternoon, I guess, but I won't. The changes that I have witnessed, of course, have been tremendous. Because when I first started going to meetings in 1935, there was just one session at a time. All of the papers had been reviewed and approved prior to the meeting and pre-printed. So that when you came to the meeting, you had preprints of everything that was going to be presented. So much more of the time was devoted to discussion. And the discussion was recorded. Of course, it was edited by Colin Fink, but at least it was recorded. Right. And, of course, everything was much more intimate, because the number of people at the meeting would be 200 or 300. As opposed to 1,500, 1,800, In ways, this was a refined thing, particularly for a young man. You got to know people that today would be very difficult. On the other hand, it limited rather severely what could be published, because the only venue for publication was the transactions of the meetings. And as the society changed, and particularly when the journal was established in 49, to publish independently of what was presented at meetings, this, of course, was a tremendous change. And I think on the whole, for the good. Although I must admit at the time that I was pretty hard to persuade that this was the way the society should go. But I'm glad it did. Now this, on the other hand, the negative part of this is that it's becoming more and more difficult for young people to meet the older, more experienced members of the society. This is the negative side of it. Another part of the negative side is that, and I think the most serious one, is that the quality of the papers presented at the meetings has deteriorated tremendously.
Is there any reason for that?
Yes. The acceptance is on the basis of abstracts rather than a complete paper. Now, it is true that the abstracts are two in number, a short one and a long one. Often they don't reflect what is really in the paper. And all too often, people are offering papers for presentation for expense accounts. Now, there are people who argue with me on this account, but I'm pretty hard to convince otherwise.
It's very easy to write an abstract.
Yes. And also, you can talk about something for 20 minutes, which is the length of time that is allowed for most papers. Now, it used to be that when you were allowed 1 hour, you needed some meat.
That's right.
Maybe not all meat, but at least you needed some meat. So here I think is a very negative side of present proceedings. Some of the papers are absolute stinkers. And they don't make it for publication at all. They just won't get by peer reviewing. But they take up time with me. Sometimes I get pretty seriously annoyed, but on the whole, I think that probably the way we operate now is the only practical way. Electoral things have changed a lot in every society, every activity.
Yes, it may be that when you reach a certain number in your membership, that after that you're going to lose certain things.
Yeah.
It doesn't make what the upper number is, but at a certain point, passing over that, which is great for the society in some respects, causes other problems. For example, you might never have met Charles Burgess if it had been 1,500 people.
I very likely wouldn't. In fact, highly improbable.
That's a very interesting point.
Incidentally, Burgess is not the only one by any means. For instance, Lawrence Addicks, a past president of the society and a quite elderly gentleman when I was a graduate student, was one of those who helped me a great deal. Principally because I met him at the Electrochemical Society meeting. Maybe it was the one in Washington, I'm not sure. But in any event, he was interested in what I was doing. And in fact, he provided me with several pounds of silver for my research project. Because he was consultant for the Silver Producers Association. And not only did he present me with the silver, but he followed up and always wanted to know what things were doing. That's one side that has pretty well disappeared. To some extent, the society, and I've had nothing to do with this, the society recently has done something that may help a little bit. They've organized poster sessions in conjunction with the semi-annual meetings at which the posters are prepared by students. And the students are present at the session where the posters are presented. This gives an opportunity for people to become acquainted. And I'm a little bit concerned about this because there have been only two sessions. One of them was very well attended, and the other one was not so well attended. There will be a third one in Reno in May of this year. I'll be watching very anxiously how it works out. The second one that wasn't well attended was in Miami Beach, and transportation difficulties may have been a factor.
Miami Beach is not a very nice place to have a meeting. At least I've never found it.
I think they really stinko, and I've said so. Particularly there since we were at the Fontainebleau.
Oh, yes, yes. Number 15. Unless there's more you want to add on 14, you said you could go on for some time there. I don't want to cut you off on that.
No, well, I could go on because I could reminisce on so many things, and going from one year to another. But I think I've summarized it, I hope, reasonably well.
Okay. How have your professional work and career and your contributions to science and technology, and I just spotted a typo there, been influenced by the meetings of the society and your contacts with the society?
Yeah, I saw the typo too.
I just noticed that.
Well, this is one on which, again, I could talk a considerable length, but I just can't overemphasize how much the society has contributed to whatever career I may have had. Not only to science and technology, but to human relationships. Working with people in the society over so many years, with so many different people and so many different activities, has been really a very contributing factor to whatever I may have done.
But it's been the contact with people, I think, as much as with the science and technology itself. But to be specific, of course, as far as academic work is concerned, the society has not been much of a factor, really. But in my consulting practice, which was quite extensive, it's been an enormous factor. Not only scientifically, in that I was able to cover so much as a source of information in the society's meetings, but also in the variety of people whom I met and either just contacted or actually worked with. It's been quite a factor. And my consulting activities were as diverse as a society. And they were diverse because of my background and way of thinking of things that came out of society activities. Although I consulted mainly in the field of corrosion and various aspects of electrometallurgy, including electroplating, I also got into quite a few other things just because I had always been interested in a variety, batteries particularly, torpedoes for another, and various aspects of photography. This one I don't talk much about. I never published anything in this field. But strangely enough, there are some metallurgical problems in photography. And well, that's enough.
Okay.
The I've sort of summarized things here, but it's difficult to do much of anything else without going into details, which I'm sure would not interest anybody. In other words, I hope I pointed out that it has been a tremendous influence, and I've had just tremendous rewards for the time that I've spent working with society activities.
Number 16, what should the society do in the future?
The easiest way to say is just keep on doing what you've been doing. But be more specific. We face, I shouldn't use the term we so much as I have in talking about current activity, because I have nothing to do now with the operation of the society except to criticize occasionally and compliment once in a while. But I still feel that I'm a part of the society's activities, in spite of the fact I'm not active. If that's confusing, that's not meant to be. But
no, I understand.
We're facing a very serious problem in publication, and the same problem that other scientific societies face. It's getting extremely expensive to publish what we publish. And more seriously, what we publish is getting buried deeper and deeper all the time. So the public, the problems in publication are really twofold. One is the hardware, the mechanism. Second is what to do with it. I don't see any solution to either of these problems, but I see them as problems that the society must deal with. And in the not very distant future either. Well, happily, this is really being addressed positively by the society. The present president is James Amick, who is very conscious of communications of problems. And he is very actively doing whatever can be done currently to try to anticipate what's going to happen to us in the future in this area. And I think that this is really the thing that is of major concern to the society for the future. We can continue doing what we have been doing in other areas. And but what we are doing in publication, which is really a critical part of the society activities, is where something has got to be done. There's just no way out. And, I don't know what it's going to be, but I'm so glad that society and its current officers are not only aware of this, but have the courage to begin addressing it. I'm looking a little bit ahead to the coming presidents, because we can always look three men, or in this case two men and a lady, ahead. I'd rather talk about, not about evaluate, what I think are the capabilities of those that will follow AMIC. First of all, I don't think I have the background. Secondly, it's too early for me to formulate any feelings. I feel, however, that the continuity that exists in our council of past presidents will keep this matter alive. And I can only hope that if the individuals involved are themselves not too critically interested, that they will be nudged by others into doing whatever can be done. So I'm hopeful that things will be all right, and very, very hopeful that at least the current attack on this problem is about all that can be done at the present time. I'm very much concerned about the burial of information, which seems to me is occurring. Present-day graduate students don't do literature search. They get their sponsor to buy databases, which are often very inadequate, largely because of indexing problems. And I can remember my own experiences in literature search, because I often had to change course in the midstream as far as how I chose where to go next. And if a computer is doing this, I'm not sure they do it well. Now, understand, I have no objection to electronic storing of information in one way or another. Something we just have to face. But I have my concern on whether or not it will always do what we would like it to do. In part because your computer doesn't put information into itself. We still have to put it in. But even more seriously, we have to know how to put it out. And perhaps, at least for a time, we have to know when to abandon what a database can give us and look at the literature for ourselves. How the society is going to be involved in this, I think, is inevitable. After all, publication is our reason for being. We've got to follow what is done. Let's hope for the best. I wish I could participate, but I can't. This area I can only view from the outside, perhaps wrongly. I hope not. Now, what else besides publication? Well, as I said before, at least in the main, what we can do is just continue doing what we've been doing. When something new comes along and needs a place, as long as at least electrons are involved,
give them a hope. Let's see what they can do. They don't always do well. There have been some new sections of the society that's flopped. Most of them, really, though, have come along. And sometimes only for a period, and sometimes as permanent members of the society. The electronics division of the society is, of course, an example. It's been a very strong part of the society, and it could well have been missed if the people of the society hadn't been willing to accept some new things. Well, the transistor, of course, is an outstanding example. And it was largely because those who were responsible for most of the work were active Electrochemical Society members and persuaded the society to start publishing more actively in this area in opposition to electrical engineers.
Was Bruce Hannay involved in that?
Yes. He's past president, of course. Even more strongly, although not so obviously, was Bob Burns.
That was his predecessor, wasn't Burns?
Yeah.
Hannay's predecessor at Bell Labs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And he, Bob was the secretary of the society, very much instrumental in changing over the society's meeting activities and publishing activities. Very, very much so. And, of course, he was past president, but he was also a very influential secretary and a gentleman, a very fine gentleman. I can remember the meeting of the board of directors at which I attended as, I think, publication chairman. And Bob told us about the transistor invention. And Jake Warner was president at the time, president of the society. And Jake and I always went to Keene's Chop House for dinner after the meetings. And our principal item of conversation was the transistor that we had heard about for the first time. And this was before it was published. It was interesting. Mm. I must say that we didn't predict very accurately. No idea at all of what it would develop into. So the society in the future should continue to do what it's been doing and not be afraid to have at whatever may be developing.
The last question is, what do you see as the future for electrochemistry? Is it alive and well?
I was going to say that I don't see any end to it. And after all, electrons are pretty well established, even though quarks and whatnot come along. seriously, electrochemical phenomena certainly will in one form or another prevail always. And I think the only thing that could really prejudice the future of the electrochemistry as a sort of a separate science is that there will get to be so many branches that will establish themselves rather strongly that electrochemistry as such, as a term, might disappear. But only as a term. I think actually the field will always remain, but it may get even more diverse branched than it is now. But there are some limiting factors to the growth, which are self-limiting. We get too many people on the board of directors
in too many fields. There's going to be a time when the elections will not be as active in some field as in others, and there will be a shift. Our board of directors is dictated, as far as numbers of directors are concerned, by our membership. We're incorporated under the laws of New York State, and there are certain restrictions, which I don't remember in detail anymore, on the number of members on the board of directors. It's mandated on in certain ways. And one of the effects of this, I think, is to sort of limit overexpansion. Simply because if you get too many fields, there will be some new ones that can't find a place on the board of directors for their officer. And to some extent, that's occurring now. It's been sort of semi-solved in a way by establishing not only sections and divisions, but also groups. And the groups have no representation on the board of directors, simply because the board of directors is filled. For those groups to become more actively represented in the affairs of the society, they just have to wait for an opening. One way to do this, of course, would be to enlarge the membership so as to provide additional seats. This is not likely to happen. I think our membership is going to stay pretty constant. It runs about 5,000 and has for some time. I think this is about the limit. I'm not sure why, but apparently this is what happens.
What's the possibility of ECS spawning a new organization if one of its divisions gets big enough to specialize enough to go out on its own?
I think there's every possibility of it. And I'm trying to remember if this has ever occurred. There's a group, I'm not sure what they're called, but it's a materials group. And this group comprises as ringleaders quite a few Electrochemical Society members. There's no friction between the new group and the society, but they do encompass areas which the Electrochemical Society has been active in, materials. I'm sorry to be so vague about this. Is Eric Pell on your list of prospective?
Not at this point. Uh-huh. And I'm not involved in selecting who goes on the list.
Uh-huh. This is... Eric is an industrial. And this group is largely comprises industrial people. And I unfortunately have to be vague about it. But I know that there is... This group is to some extent an offspring of the Electrochemical Society, although they may not realize it nor claim it, because it's the same people that comprise both groups. But I think this is an unusual. I think more frequently the field has petered out and thereby relieved the Electrochemical Society of an area which is no longer very important. And I can give a very specific example of this, and that's the field of electrothermics. When I joined the society, this was the ringleader group. And they were mainly interested in carbon electrodes,
either for electric furnace operation or for industrial electrolysis like chlorine alkali. And they were very powerful. Today they are as nothing. Mm-hmm. But they have not established any area of interest. Largely because there's very little going on in that field and very likely not to go on, particularly in the making of electrodes for electrothermic operations. It's rather different in the chlorine caustic. This is a very, very important field for electrode development, but not graphite and carbon. This is a new area entirely, which has been very strong in the society, but they are not electrothermics. Mm-hmm. The electrothermics is steel making and abrasive making, silicon carbide and graphite itself. Those were strong, very strong people, and supported the society financially as well as scientifically, but they have just faded away. Mm. And I think this has happened to some extent in practical electroplating. There's hardly anything now in the activities of the Electrochemical Society having to do with actually producing a product. This has been taken over pretty well and properly by the Electroplaters Society. It's been taken over, but horribly done. So here was an area within the society's section, or division rather, which is lost in one way, but still is with us in a new way. And this has happened in other fields also. And, of course, I've been very closely associated with the electroplating or electrodeposition field. And perhaps this has made me a little bit more conscious of what has happened there. But it used to be that the electrodeposition division papers were largely actually concerned with actually electrodepositing metal. Today, the electrodeposition division people never deposit any metal. All they do is rig up their galvanostats or potentiostats and their other stats and publish curves, which is fine. That's fine. I'm not objecting at all. But it's just shown what can happen within a division without losing the division itself, but with losing completely not only the subject matter, but the people. For instance, I'm getting to the point where almost all of the people that I knew well in my own field have either died or completely retired and never have any attendance at meetings at all. I'm getting to that point. So some of the things I say are pretty well dated.
Well, that brings us to the end of my list, but certainly is there anything else that you would like to add at this point?
It's been a very complete list. Really, there's nothing much that I can add to what I've already said, perhaps at too much length. But I try to think of what I might do currently that would be of some value to the society. And happily, there isn't very much. I'm a consultant to the group that are planning the 100th anniversary celebration. And all I'm doing is criticizing a little bit and making a few suggestions. About as rewarding as I can get at the present time.
You also, but you said you were also writing these things for Interface, too,
yeah.
Which I think very useful, very helpful.
I'm not sure that it's helpful. I said, I think, that some of the things were accompanied by a bit of, not poetic license, but prosaic license. Also, occasionally I indulge in what I like to call the poo-bah syndrome. You know what I'm referring to?
I think so.
Poo-bah of Mikado.
Mm-hmm.
in other words, occasionally do a little bit of decoration to, as Poo-bah said, to lend verisimilitude to an otherwise bald and an interesting story. Well, one of the things that, as far as the society is, I'm concerned about, frankly, is a successor to Sally Kilfoyle. She's the director of publications and an extremely capable and very interesting woman. It'll be hard to find somebody the equal of her. I'm continually astonished at what is done in the way of physically publishing material with such a small staff. I've had, in one way or another, a fair amount to do with publication, and I just sometimes can't believe how much material they turn out of good quality with such a small staff. And I'm always interested in comparing the staff for National Geographic with staff for the Journal of the Electrochemical Society. Frankly, I think that turning out the National Geographic ought to be done by not more than five or six people, with two of them not doing much of anything, because it's really a poorly edited magazine, in my opinion. But they have hundreds of people making mistakes, occasionally doing something right. Whereas Sally has about five or six people and turning out. Well, have you ever looked at the Journal of the Electrochemical Society?
Not recently. I've looked at it years ago, but...
This is half of this month's edition. Mm. As I read it, I tear things out. Occasionally I keep something, more often I don't. It's something I learned from Clyde Crowley during the war. We had a lot of traveling to do during the war, and a lot of waiting to do in stations. Clyde Crowley always had a detective story, and he'd read a page, put it over his shoulder to whoever was behind. But there'd be page after page of... I'm trying to find the worst of it. You know, always when you're looking for something that's behind the door. What I'm looking for is a typical page of mathematical material. It's not mathematical. It was a horrible editorial problem. Here's a double column table, a single column table, and illustrations. You have no idea of how much of a problem this is to edit unless you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
because you don't want to end up with any blank space.
Right.
The other one, which I don't find, because this section doesn't have much math in it, but the pages that are gone had a great deal of math, and this is just a nightmare for proofreaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, when there'll be page after page of this kind of expression.
I can appreciate that.
But this is half of 1 month getting this out, plus proceedings, plus interface, plus extended abstracts, and some other publications. I don't see how they do. Well, in any event, I think we covered things pretty well. Well, at least I hope so.
Oh, absolutely, and I certainly appreciate your spending the time with me this afternoon.
Yeah, I don't envy the job of editing it.
Well, that's not as bad as transcribing. The person who puts this on paper is the one who spends most of the time.
Yeah. Well.
I think we've got some very good information, and I certainly appreciate your sharing your experiences and history with me this afternoon.
Well, it's the least I could do. Milner approached me about participating in this. I must say that I took a day or so to consider it, because I was wondering whether it would be worth not only my time, but more importantly, the time of whoever did the interview. In other words, you. Well, but I decided at least had to keep somebody busy.
Well, I think it's been very good, and I really do appreciate it.
Well,
that's our standard release form.